Chapter 5. Like a wounded seagull driven before the wind, the Trinidad Valencera battled her way around the northern coastline of Tyrconnell. Apart from the sheer size of her, there was little left to show that she had once been the pride of the Levantine squadron in the greatest armada that Spain or any other country in the world had ever assembled. That glorious dream was over, shattered in one battle off the coast of France, and the southerly winds which had saved the Trinidad Valencera from the Dunkirk shoals had not, in the end, proved kind to her. Driven north and unable to regain the Channel Passage, she had been forced to set a course around the top of Scotland. Now the autumn gales of the North Atlantic were completing the work begun by the English cannons. Her sails were shredded, her rigging damaged, and she had lost her heaviest anchors, cut them, and run on that terrible night off Calais, when Drake's fire ships had come sailing out of the darkness on the flood tide, spitting flames like a pride of vengeful dragons. Below the decks, she was a floating pest house. There was no food. What little water remained lay in green, putrid puddles at the bottom of barrels. Her crew were dying. More than 500 men, her own and those rescued from the sinking Barco de Hamburgo, lay crammed together in a space designed for less than a quarter of that number. They were starving, half crazed with thirst, and suffering from wounds, scurvy and dysentery. Soon, they would all be too weak to man the pumps or take their turn at steering.
"Take great heed lest you fall upon the island of Ireland,"
their commander, the Duke of Medina Sidonia, had warned his captains,
"for fear of the harm that may happen upon you on that coast."
But the Trinidad Valencera had no choice. With her canvas torn and spars shattered, she could do nothing but run before the southwesterlies. Besides, if she did not find food and clean water, her crew would be dead long before she reached. Floating in the Atlantic, the journey was becoming more dangerous with every hour that passed. She ploughed through Inishtrawl Sound and eastward along the coast of Inishowen, until finally she dropped her remaining anchors in Glenageavy Bay.
"Your position is hopeless," declared Henry Hovenden. "Your ship is wrecked, your men are dying, you have nowhere to go. Surrender to me, and I will conduct you safely to Dublin, and see that you are sent to London to plead your case."
Colonel Alonso de Lizon swayed on his feet and considered the offer. What the Englishman said was true. The Trinidad Valencera had broken up in Glenageavy Bay, and he and his wretched band of survivors had been on the road for 12 days since, looking for food and shelter. They would be no match for Hovenden's private army. But surrender? He was an officer in the army of His Most Catholic Majesty, King Philip of Spain, and these starving men were his responsibility. He had heard stories of how the English treated their prisoners.
"Your soldiers are hungry," pressed the Englishman, as if reading his mind. "And exhausted. You have come far on little food. They are brave men. Do not force them into further suffering. Surrender now, and I will see they are fed and rested before we march to Dublin."
"He is lying," said one part of the Lizon's mind. "He is a lying Englishman, and you cannot trust him." But the other part, the part that craved sleep and food, knew that he could do little else.
"And our money? And Châtel's?"
he quibbled, hearing his own voice from a distance, and amazed at how weak he sounded.
"The goods we salvaged from our ship?"
"Your possessions are forfeit to the crown as spoils of war. I cannot deprive Her Majesty of what is legally hers. However, I will permit each private soldier to keep his best suit of clothing, and each gentleman to retain 2. That is my final offer."
De Lizon knew that he should refuse, but he felt his exhaustion pressing down like an anvil on his shoulders. He looked at his army and then bowed his head.
"Very well," he conceded. I yield to your terms and I trust in your honor to observe them.
Like sleepwalkers, the starving company of soldiers shuffled forward and lay down their arms. Swords, muskets, and pikes were stacked in a heap before the gloating eyes of Henry Hovenden and his brother. De Lauzon watched wretchedly. See their greed, accused his mind. See how they count the weapons, how they calculate the reward they will get when they present them to their queen. You have sold your freedom to men who have no honor. They will not keep their promises. His heart heard the words and knew them to be true, but he lacked the energy to worry. He swayed on his feet and imagined himself lying down and never having to rise again. When the last weapon had been surrendered, the company moved off, bound, so the Hovendens told them, for Castle Burt, a stronghold of one Sean O'Doherty, Lord of Inishowen. It was an astonishingly slow progress, for many of the Spaniards were too weak to walk, and their companions in little state to assist them. They had just skirted a large bog which lay between them and the castle when a commotion broke out towards the back of the column. De Lauzon turned to see what was happening. An English soldier, pretending to assist a fallen prisoner, had pulled off the man's cloak and was searching the hems for hidden coins. The Spaniard was too weak to protest, but some of his companions had gone to his aid. As De Lauzon approached the group, one of them shoved the soldier away. The trooper's hand flew to his hip, a dagger flashed, and one of the Spaniards staggered backwards, clutching at his chest. At once, pandemonium erupted. Like wolves set loose, the troopers fell on the rest of the prisoners and began to strip them of everything they owned, tearing, ripping, dragging off boots and clothing, and killing anyone who resisted. The suddenness of the attack was as frightening as its brutality. De Lauzon was bewildered. He tried feebly to push his way through the scrum. Hands seized him and threw him to the ground. They beat him, tore at him, turned and twisted him, stripped him of everything he wore. Voices screeched at each other, fighting over his possessions. He struggled helplessly. Someone grabbed him by the hair. Then something, a fist, a musket, a knife hilt, struck him across the side of his head, and he passed out. He came round to a sick and eerie calm. A silence, broken only by the sobs of men driven beyond endurance, and the crying of the injured and the dying. The frenzy was over. De Lauzon shut his eyes. He never wanted to open them again. He was naked, but that didn't matter. Nothing mattered. All he wanted to do was lie still, undisturbed, and wait for death. He felt himself sliding back into a consciousness. Then, not far away, a man shrieked, a wild, gibbering sound that rose to a crescendo and ended, too suddenly, in a choking gurgle. De Lauzon remembered his duty, remembered that he was a colonel in the Spanish army and that these men were in his care. He dragged himself to his feet and looked around. The scene was like a painting of hell. Scarecrow figures staggered across a nightmare landscape, or sprawled naked on the earth, too weak or too stunned to move. Some were bleeding, some were probably dead. One or two, driven over the edge into madness, crawled around on all fours, meowing like little lost kittens. Around them, blood smeared and sweating, clutching their spoils and grinning like demons out of the inferno, stood the Hovenden's troopers. De Lauzon staggered across to where Henry Hovenden was stood with his brother Richard.
"Is this how you keep your word?" he gasped. "Is this your concept of honor? You are no better than animals. I was a fool to trust the word of an Englishman."
Henry Hovenden's heavy features flushed with anger. His brother took a step forward.
"Have a care what you say, Spaniard. I could have my men fillet you where you stand."
De Lauzon almost laughed. His detached mind was whispering to him with brittle clarity.
"And lose the ransom I will bring you?" he jeered. "Your queen, that evil witch, with no more honor than you, who rewards you for your treachery, would not thank you for that."
Richard Hovenden swore, and made as though to draw his sword, but his brother laid a hand on his arm.
"I regret what has happened," he said to Le Lison. "It was not of my doing or by my orders. I cannot restore your belongings. My men have claimed them as trophies of war, and to despoil them would be difficult and dangerous. However, the castle is only 2 miles distant, and I promise that you shall have clothing found for you when we reach it."
Deleuzon looked into his face and knew that he was lying.
"We cannot walk another 2 miles," he said. "Without food and rest, we cannot walk another 100 yards. We are all dying, all of us."
Hovenden frowned.
"Then we shall make camp here for the night.
And in the morning, we shall be weaker than we are today."
"I will send to the castle," promised Henry Hovenden, "and see that you are all well fed before we move out."
The day passed, and another night of starvation. The night was beyond imagining. Naked and defenseless, separated from his men, and penned in a square formed by armed troopers, Deleuzon huddled with his fellow officers through the hours of darkness. None of them slept, for they knew that those who did would surely not wake again. Morning came, and there was still no sign of food, but Deleuzon had not expected any. It had become obvious to him that their large number was an inconvenience to their captors, that the fewer prisoners who actually reached the castle, the better pleased the Englishman would be. He wondered if he would even make it himself. Though he had dragged his body into a sitting position, he had not yet attempted to stand again, and he was not sure if he was capable of doing so. He looked across at the English camp. The Hovenden brothers had spent the night in comfort in their own tent. They were standing before it now, talking to a man and woman in Irish dress who had ridden over from the castle. The newcomers made an odd couple. The man was crouched over and frail-looking. The woman had a hardness about her that was almost masculine. Her dark hair shone like burned copper in the morning sun, and it was she who appeared to be doing all the talking. Deleuzon wondered who they were. He sensed a new danger, though he could not imagine what it might be. He saw one of the Hovedens shake hands with the old man. Watching, Deleuzon wrapped his arms around his aching chest and shivered. The camp began to break up. The horsemen saddled and moved out. The foot soldiers began to gather the prisoners, prodding them to their feet and urging them to walk. As they stumbled away, Deleuzon tried to count those left behind, the still forms that would never rise again. He staggered to his feet and awaited his orders, but none came. The guards surrounding him and his fellow officers held firm, and when he tried to move forward, one of them shoved him back, sending him sprawling to the ground. He lay on his back in the dirt, his all-seeing mind hovering somewhere above him, looking down on him pitilessly. "You know, don't you?" it said with icy logic. "You know what is going to happen now."
"No!"
Deleuzon heaved himself up again. He saw his soldiers grouped like a regiment of scarecrows on a piece of open ground, a bare 200 yards from the camp. He saw the line of foot soldiers bearing down on them with primed muskets. He saw the cavalry on the far side of the field.
"No!" he screamed again. "Madre de Dios, no!"
He lurched forward, but the guards seized him and held him back. And then the trumpet sounded.